Let's get started on our second session. I almost said okay, but I keep thinking to myself, I'm not going to say it the very first word, so get past all that. So we're almost through the details and the heads up on things, and I'll be able to get into some of the actual code that you'll be using to do the checking. One thing I'm going to talk about, and this thing you may not be familiar with, it's sort of the odd duck in programming languages, is labels. Older languages use labels extensively. A label is simply a marker. In some languages, they were numbers. In other languages, they're identifiers to say, here's a particular point in a program. In the old days, programs used go-tos. And with go-to, you could synthesize almost any structure you wanted. And old programs are full of go-tos. Does cache have go-tos in it? Yeah. And you've seen them used wisely, and you've seen them used poorly, I would imagine. Yeah. And it happens that more modern languages, for example, Java has no go-tos at all. That's a little surprising because it's a comprehensive language. CSX doesn't. That's mostly because it's simple enough. I think C# does have go-tos. Is that correct? But you use them judiciously?
Has go-tos, but you should almost never use them.
Yeah. Okay, and that's probably the right approach, the situation there. So with go-tos gone, labels are less important, but they still persist. And they are odd because most things in programming languages that are labeled are in some sense manipulable or dynamic. You can do a computation with it. A method can do a computation. A variable has a value. Even a constant has a value. But label is just sort of a marker. And yet they still persist. And in our language and in Java, and I think in C#, they exist at least in one context, namely to use a very restricted form of go-to, something so restricted that it's not even called a go-to, two of them actually, called break and continue. These are two flows of control that are important in loops. A break says, break me out of the iteration. Continue says, stop this iteration and go and try the next. So it's a way of, if you have something where you're computing some number of iterations, any maximum, say you're searching for the first negative value in an array. So you say, I'm going to search each element, but if I find a negative value, I'm going to break out and stop at this point. Or maybe the case you're in a computation and you say, this one's a loser. I want to try the next one and continue with the next iteration, but don't finish this iteration because I've decided it can't possibly work. You're looking for the solution for something, and you say, no, this can't be it. Try again. Well, in those particular cases, when you break or continue a particular loop, it's important to know which loop you're talking about because loops can be nested. Now, in Java, there's an implicit labeling or an explicit labeling. I've simplified it and created labels for only one purpose, namely on loops. The only kind of loops we have are while loops. If you're looking for extra credit, one thing you could do is add into the language for loops. For loops are while loops with a little bit of initialization and a little bit of automatic incrementation. They're extremely useful. Almost all programs of any size will use a for loop. But there's something that's not fundamental. A while loop can be used with a little bit of extra code to get the effect of a for loop. So that's one thing you might want to add. But at any rate, if I have several nested loops, so I have while, and I say a break or a continue right here. In Java, there's a rule about the nearest match or not. What I've gone ahead and simply said, if you do a break or continue, you've got to label the loop. That's no big deal because you don't do them all that often. So I would say, for example, break L. And this is break out of loop L, and that'd be that one. So identifiers do appear on while loops in the form of labels. Okay, that's no big deal, except for the fact that when you put them in the symbol table, notice they don't have the usual scoping that identifiers would have, because normally identifiers are at the level of a class, a method, or a block. But a label is really at the level of a loop. From inside the loop, the label is very important. From outside the loop, it's totally unimportant. You cannot break or continue a loop unless you're in it, either directly or indirectly through nesting. So it has a sort of funny rules. Now, what we're going to do in our language is simply say that a label is an identifier like anything else. It can only be declared once. So if I have a label L, there's only one L that's declarable in the current scope, and it's of kind or type label. I guess we'd say, in this particular case, it's kind is label. I guess we say its type is void, I think, because it has no value. So we have a couple of rules that say that. An identifier that labels a while loop is considered to be local in that scope, in the containing scope. No other declaration is allowed. Similar in a break, you have to have a label, and the label must be on a while loop that encloses you. If people are looking for a little bit of extra credit beyond the for loop, here's one that you might actually enjoy doing. It's not too hard, and it's an improvement. Namely, we talked a little bit about overloading. And remember, overloading is sharing of names. In my lecture, I'm going to show you that Java has perhaps gone too far. In Java, you can have the same name in the same spot in the program represent at least five different things, maybe six. Let's see, you can have it be a package name, a class name, a constructor name, a method name, and a field name. That's five. All kind of coexisting. And that's kind of overdoing it, the situation there. But overloading to some extent is useful. Constructors are overloaded extensively so that you can have constructors that provide some parameters and not others. Methods are overloadable where you can have some parameters default and others be explicit. So for example, oftentimes, if you want to have an exponentiation routine called power, you might write a method declared as this. It says, take base to the power of the exponent. So 2 squared, 3 cubed, 4, 4th, or whatever you want. But since power is oftentimes used with an exponent of 2, you could have an overloaded version that says, you'll provide the base. And if you don't provide the exponent, it's by default 2, which is the most common one. So here's a case where you have two definitions of POW coexisting. Well, in our language, we do allow overloading of methods. But something you could probably do safely is allow a label in a scope to coexist with some other usage of the same name, a variable, a method, a field, whatever. It turns out that because they are so very different, they hardly ever interact. So labels are sort of like the neutrino of programming languages. Neutrinos are one of those things, they do exist, but they're extremely, extremely, extremely hard to find. In fact, there's a UW scientist who, you know, he's a dedicated scientist because he goes to Antarctica in the middle of winter to have this huge detector that goes ahead and detects neutrinos. And I guess just nature being what it is, I think there's not just one kind of neutrinos. Anybody a physicist here? Are there three kinds of neutrinos, I think? Three. And he can tell the difference between them. And neutrinos are the sort of things that this thing can shoot through the entire Earth and has, does anybody know the number? A minuscule, probably less than 1 in a billion chance of being interacted with. So, you know, talk about being shielded from neutrinos. And labels are like that. I mean, they're there, but, you know, they interact so weakly with everything else that pretending they don't exist is almost reasonable. So I'll talk a little bit about how to, when we're doing about breaks and continues, how to handle labels. But an alternative, which would be a good design improvement, would be to say labels may coexist. What that would mean is that in the symbol table for our scope, you can have a definition of something like L for any of the basic types, variable, constant, method, parameter, whatever. And you can also have a second alternative definition for label, because it's almost impossible to confuse them. You can't assign to a label, you can't pass a label as a parameter, you can't read a label, you can't write a label. All you can do is break and continue with a label. But you can't break and continue with a variable, you can't break or continue with a method, you can't break or continue with a constant. So again, they just don't interact. They kind of fly by each other without mutual interaction. So if you wanted to get a little bit of a flavor of doing overloading and get a little bit of extra credit, it's not a terribly hard thing to do. And if anything, it probably makes your break and continue handling a little simpler. And when we talk about that, I'll explain that. But I thought I'd mention that. It's in the language the way it is because I wanted to keep symbol tables fairly straightforward. But it is unsatisfying to some extent. So a void method of no arguments main must be the last method declared in a class that constructs, constitutes a CSX program. And by the way, you're going to have to check that. It's not only that main must exist, but it must be the very last method in the whole list of methods that exists. Question is, how do you find that out? And what you probably need to do is go in and take your actual root of the actual class, which is a root of a CSX program. Go into its method subtree and find the very rightmost child in there to check that in fact is main. Now, why am I doing that? What is main? Well, main is exactly is this job. It's where you start executing. But can anybody guess why I'm requiring that main be the last, the very bottommost method in the class? Yeah.
Because you had specified a rule where you had to have the function defined before it
was called.
That's right.
So main wasn't the last thing you could call anything. That's absolutely right. Or certainly anything that follows it. Because we wouldn't see it. That's right. Execution starts at main, and the gentleman is absolutely correct here, that we have a rule, and I'm going to get to it very shortly, that we have no forward references. Until you see a declaration for something in a scope, it does not exist. And therefore, if main did not come last, anything that followed it would be unreachable, because it does not know it exists, and therefore cannot be used. So as an artifact of the fact we don't have any forward references, main comes last. It's oftentimes the case people program main as last anyway, so it's fairly common to usage. But in our language, it's absolutely mandatory. So that's something you'll have to check by actually going in, looking at the structure of the program, and finding is the rightmost, the last in the list of the methods named main. So just make a note of that mentally or on paper. The size of an array must be greater than zero. So we're just simply not allowed to have an array of zero elements because there's nothing I can anticipate you'll use with zero elements. So we're just disallowing that. And only integer or char may be used to index arrays. So anyway, that was just an overview of what we're going to do. Let's actually take a look now. Oh, it's died again. And talk about how to implement this. So the reading assignment is actually the section on type checking, and it'll be relevant to what we're doing. Symbol tables. You worked on symbol tables, and we were just discussing them a moment ago, back in Project 1. If you have a working symbol table you're happy with, you're welcome to use it. It turns out that in the startup of Project 4, we have a symbol table included because we have enough type checking that includes scoping that I wanted to demonstrate that. So if you want to, you're welcome to take the symbol table we have implemented in the startup before and use it as an alternative. It's your choice, but you will need a symbol table. It's going to be the block-structured symbol table we talked about. And in our particular case, as in CSX, you'll actually create symbol tables at several points. And I want to go through them and mention that. So at certain points, the most important one of which is the root node. That'd be the class node when you move over to full CSX. You're going to have a symbol table that contains all the declarations in the program at the global level, all except one. There's one name that does not go in there, and that is the name of the class. It's one of these situations, classes have names, but since we have only one class, we don't really use the name for anything until we get around to code generation. Because when we get around to code generation, Java says classes must have names. So a class is going to have a name, but it doesn't go into any symbol table. It doesn't clash with anything because it's not used in any way. There's only one class. It's like saying the Earth or the universe. It's there, but giving it a name is, in a sense, superfluous. If there were more Earths or more universes, it might be more fun. So be a little careful about that. There's something in my list of things here that says the class name has to be a valid identifier. The scanner checks that. And beyond that, it doesn't matter. You're going to use it, but whatever it is, it can't go wrong. It can't clash with anything. It can't be bad or good. I guess it could be vaguely obscene or something. I don't know what the rules around here are about using bad names or something. That's another thing, bad thing we did when I was first learning programming is variable names had to have cute names, and sometimes they're a tad too cute. So what you're going to do is when you begin processing the root, the very beginning of your particular type checker, you're going to create a symbol table. That means you're going to actually go ahead and create a symbol table structure. Again, the one you had in Project 1, or you can borrow the one we have. And this will be made available throughout the entire main scope. Actually, you're going to have a block structure symbol table always available. So it makes sense in this case probably to create a field in your type checker that's globally accessible that says, here's the current scope I'm using. That will be at least the global variables at class. And when you're inside of a method or inside of a block, you'll add extra scopes in a list following the block structure symbol table rules. So you'll create one at the very beginning, and that will essentially be stay open throughout the entire life of a program. Now, another thing I'll give you a heads up on, because it occurs from time to time, is people are surprised that when you get done with type checking, symbol tables go away. Because we have another phase, code generation, later on, that's going to say, well, don't we need a symbol table again when I do code generation? If I call a method, for example, I'm going to need to know something about where the method is or what its types are or something like that. And it turns out the little trick we're going to play, and you'll see that in the code that I've distributed for startup, is we won't use, we'll destroy a symbol table at the end of type checking because the key thing we will have done, namely figure out for each identifier what its corresponding declaration, we'll have a link already established. So let me show you that to make it clear. What's going to happen is in the symbol table, remember, in the type checker, remember we need a symbol table because I might have a declaration at one point and a use at a very different point. And there's a rule, all kinds of rules about what you may print. In this case, if I is an int, you will know it's valid. So type checking does need a symbol table. What's going to happen, you're going to say, okay, here's an identifier. I need to know something about its type. I'm going to check the symbol table and find where is the closest declaration of I. If there is no declaration, you print out an error message, an undeclared identifier. That's something you may have to worry about. But what you'll do is you'll find this declaration in the symbol table and say, okay, when the thing was declared, I created a symbol table entry that said for I, what's its type? Its type is int. What's its kind? Well, this is declared as variable, so we'll consider it to be a variable. Fields are variables. Local variables are variables, things that are scalars and changeable. So it says, okay, this guy is fine. He's a variable. I can print a variable. His type is int. I know how to type a print. That's fine. But eventually, the symbol table containing this declaration is going to go away. But what's going to happen is in the actual AST, I can create a link after I look them up to the node I found. That means if in future, when I'm walking the AST, for example, for code generation purposes, I say, hey, I need to have some extra information about I. For example, where is he located? What's his address? How do I access him? I'll have a direct reference that says, here it is. And the code generator may, for example, say, oh yeah, I have an integer I, and it's going to have an address of maybe 10. So at location 10, and we'll explain how that's all done, is where you'll find the memory allocated for the variable that's named int I. And you'll simply be able to say that's there. So this linkage between a use and a declaration will first be resolved in type checking. But what we'll do is we'll actually go ahead and set physical links from the use to the declaration point that will persist in the AST for future uses. Because of that, you don't need to look it up a second or a third time. It's like looking something up in a phone book or something. Isn't that anachronistic? People still talk about phone books, but however you happen to look up in a directory or something, and even though phone books no longer exist, and when you look up a number, do you still kind of write it on your arm or something or whatever? In the old days, you look it up and you write it on there and hope it's not indelible ink or something that takes a month to erase off. So I just give you a heads up on that. You'll see that if you're looking at the code carefully, but it always bothers people in my actual explanation, I'm going to say at some point, destroy the symbol table, remove the symbol table. And that seems like a terrible thing to do. But remember, when I destroy a symbol table, I'm not destroying the data inside the symbol table. All I'm destroying is the mechanism that said from this particular identifier name to that particular usage, there's a bond. This is a use of that declaration as contrasted with other possible declarations. Once I've resolved that by using the block structured rules, I just remember it. And again, the analogy is you looked up somebody's phone number, maybe in an old-style phone book. Does Epic still even have phone books anymore? They have a little Epic phone book or something? No. Just look it up online, right, or something, or something like that. Or just yell out, hey, you, or whatever, and see who comes running. So anyway, that's the notion there. And if you see that and you're wondering why I'm allowed to throw away a symbol table, it's not I'm throwing it away. Instead, it served its purpose. And from now on, I've got a better alternative, namely a direct link from the I to the exact declaration I knew at type checking time had to be the appropriate declaration that this I was talking about. So continuing that then, besides a class note, whenever I visit a method, and remember, most of our code will be in methods, just as is in Java. When I'm inside of a method, I can have local declarations, parameters, etc. in the method. So what will happen then is I'll go along and I'll still have the global class. Symbol table. There's always exactly one of those created at the beginning, persisting until the end. When I enter a method, and in our language, methods don't nest. In full Java, classes can nest, and hence methods can nest inside classes. That's a tad too complex for us. So methods do not nest. They exist collaterally. So I can have many methods, but not one is not inside the other. They're siblings, in effect. So in this case, I can have a method symbol table. And inside of a method, I can have blocks of code, and blocks can have local declarations. So they'll have a symbol table. Blocks, however, can nest. So I can have some number of blocks. That's something like I have int a, blah, 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 bool b, blah, 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 close, close. Yeah, good point. There we go, something like that. So what's going to be happening is as you're doing type checking, you'll always have access to the global class symbol table, either at the very top of the list or down the sequence. Down the sequence means that it will only be consulted if it's the case that there are no intermediate declarations. You'll be in a method most of the time, not always. When you're processing fields, you won't be in a method yet. And once you're inside of a method, you may have one or more blocks that have their own local declarations. So you could have something like. And remember how the lookup mechanism works, and we're giving you that so you don't have to re-implement it if you had problems with it, is you'll check the innermost block, the containing block, the method, and the symbol table. Now, a couple of things that we'll have to worry about, and one of those I've mentioned, and we'll mention it again because it comes up again and again. When I process a method, it's a little odd in how I create symbol tables because a method has a name. And, of course, all good methods are named method M. But the name of a method does not go in its own symbol table. It actually goes in the global symbol table. And a method, of course, can access it. A method can be recursive, so it can call itself. But what happens is it says, do I have a local declaration of M? Probably not. I then go to the global and says, is there a declaration of M globally at the class level? And the answer is yes, namely me, and that's how I do recursion. The reason for that is, remember that when I close a method and go to another one, it's the case that the local declarations of the method are lost. They're no longer accessible. But I certainly want the method itself to be accessible. Otherwise, one method could never call another. And particularly, main could never call any of the other methods because they would have all been processed and closed by the time I got to main. So it seems a little odd until you think it through. But the name of a method goes in the containing scope. And right after the name, the parameters and all the locals then go into a symbol table that's particular only to that method. So following that, and whenever I hit a method decl node, I create another symbol table. I create a brand new symbol table and link it into the structure for the block structured symbol table. And this will continue to be used until I fully processed all the subtrees in a method. When I'm about to return from the type checking visit to method, I can destroy that symbol table, let go, because all the names that ever will be looked up have been looked up, and any linkages, as I talked about a few moments ago, have been established between an identifier and the corresponding declaration of it. And when you have a block node, a very similar thing, blocks may or may not have declarations. If you wanted to be minor optimization, you could check in a block and say, are there any field decals in that block? Only create a symbol table if there aren't. I think in simplicity, I just create it, and if it's empty, it's empty, and I throw it away. It's a little bit of wastage, but computers being as fast as they are these days, it's kind of a false economy. I don't know, are there any rules of the shop here about doing tiny little optimizations that complicate the logic? It's probably considered a bad idea. It's hard to avoid because you want to do things elegantly, but sometimes the extra checking, you know, are you null or not? Somebody says, oh, he's doing something deep. Is it null or not? And all you're doing is saying, I don't want to unnecessarily create and destroy an empty symbol table. They're not that expensive. Computers are mucho, mucho fast, so I wouldn't worry about it, but I can understand if you're particular about that sort of thing. Yes, here's the thing I was talking about, forward references. I'm going to explain how they simplify, and if you want to do full forward references, that's a good thing. One of the things forward references would allow you to do is something that we do not have in CSX, namely mutual recursion. We do have recursion. A routine may call itself, but I cannot have something like so A calls B. Calls A. Something like that. That exists in languages that allow forward references, potentially, but not in our language. Why? Well, what forward references say is that an identifier is usable only at the point it's declared. Until it's declared, it does not exist. So that means if I do processing A and it sees a call to B, it says, what B? I don't know any B. And rearranging these, of course, doesn't any good because then you see B first, you don't see A. If I had forward references, I would allow that. Now, first of all, are there any routines that would potentially be useful by having mutual recursion of this sort? We studied one only a couple of lectures back. Remember recursive descent where you had those cool parsing procedures? They required mutual recursion in that, you know, expression you call a term call expression and back and forth and all that sort of nonsense. So that's supportable. I don't think mutual recursion is as important as direct recursion, certainly for our learning process, so I simply haven't included it. But again, if you wanted to extend your language to allow forward references, you could do it. It's not hard in some ways, but I'll show you some of the complexities of why we backed off of it. And in fact, here's part of it. In this particular case, let's look at these two assignments. In this particular case, without forward references, if I see a declaration I gets J, that's potentially accessible. But in this case, the J I'm initializing with is not the J on the line immediately below it. That's a forward reference. It could be that these declarations are inside of a nested scope and there's an outer J that is accessible because it's already been processed. It would mean that one. That makes sense to the thing, but notice there's always a little bit of a problem because if these two really were adjacent to each other, somebody might be tempted to believe that these are mutually referencing each other. Turns out, by the way, that you're not losing a darn thing here. I'll show you when we get around to Java that that exists, but all it does is complicate Java by allowing it. And in fact, can anybody tell me what's wrong with this if I had forward references? There's something still wrong with that. I can still say, okay, the line I must be talking about J for its initializer, and the line J below it must be talking about I. There's a circularity, and that's not too reassuring. But what is it about just a language processing that would say something bad about this? Well, notice what's happening is this initialization is actual executable code. Normally, when a variable is initialized, particularly if it has a non-trivial initializer, code is executed. That is, if I say, you know, here's a class C equals and call a constructor to build an object of it, that sort of thing is executing code. But in this particular case, I'm referencing J, and even if I allow forward references to say, I know what J is, it's the guy ahead of me, one line further, this guy is not completed yet. So Java would have to say, hey, you can't really use this guy. You can talk about him, but he's not complete yet. You're talking about using a value that hasn't been initialized because I haven't gotten to that point yet, and I haven't executed any initialization code. Even if I allow forward references, I can only do one thing at a time, assuming I don't have concurrent processors. And any of you know about concurrency, would initializing both of these guys simultaneously be a good idea? Probably not. You know, there's all sorts of race issues and all that. I mean, there's race problems of one sort. This is race conditions of the computing part, and it's bad in its own right, too. So in this case, this thing would not be allowable anyway. So you're not losing as much as you think. And if you decide to allow forward references, we have a TA who likes to check for oddball conditions, as people were noticing. He checked, how many was it, 100-plus errors? I mean, I didn't even know there were that many cases that were possible, but he was a busy, busy man. So, but most of you passed them beautifully. I mean, it must be a grade. I mean, I never did take an exam where I passed, 160-some tests and got perfect on each of them. So if you got 100 on this, you did really well. You tested you up, down, left, and right. But anyway, if you allowed forward references, it would mean that this J was talking about this guy, but it would still not be valid. Because you cannot, even though you know what he's talking about, until what happens in Java is that something is really accessible only when it's fully processed. And in this case, knowing that's I is not the same thing as saying its initialization is complete. So that's the gotcha on forward references. So how would you do forward references if you were in Java or you wanted to extend CSX? The basic idea is to separate two passes down the AST. That means you walk the AST once merely to gather the declarations. That would say, I know in this scope, I have this declaration and that, even if they're physically below where I currently am. So I gather together all the methods, all the fields of something in a particular class. That's exactly what Java does. Java says you may reference a field in a method, for example. And that's valid. So in Java, you're allowed forward reference to the part inside of a class C. I could have some method M that says print A, and then have the A declared later. That thing is actually allowed because what would happen is before this execution ever occurred, the initialization of A, let's initialize it just to make it nicer. Something like this, even though that's a forward reference, this is a benign forward reference in that it's simply saying I don't have to worry too much about ordering my methods and fields. If they're in the same class, it'll say anywhere in the class is acceptable. So there's a case where it would be acceptable. But what would happen is the type checker for Java would make two passes. It would say at the first pass, there are two declarations. One is for method M, that's void, and the other is an integer A, that's initialized. And then later on, when it did checking, it would say, okay, you're printing an A. Okay, A is an integer. By the time I get around to printing them, this thing will be completed in terms of its initialization. Remember, things are initialized in the class before you ever execute the body of the class. So in this particular case, it would say, okay, that's A, and everything would work out fine. So one pan, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. I wouldn't. Yeah. I meant like that. Yeah. So in this particular situation, pass one says get all the declarations, then pass two, find all the uses. So think of it as those parts of the code that enter something into the symbol table are all done in advance before any lookups are ever done, and then the lookups come. So that's what the two passes are all about if you allow forward references. Again, the base language we have doesn't require that. So in this particular case, in our language, if this were at this stage, it would say print A. It says, I don't know of any A unless there's one outside and above. So it would say this is an undeclared identifier because it hasn't been seen yet. So we have a more restrictive ordering, but it's also perhaps in a sense a little more readable. Again, I think Java's probably made good sense that it allows forward references in classes. It does not allow forward references in all places. I believe in ordinary variables inside of a block. There, forward references are disallowed. So, you know, situation there. Sometimes you have to bend the rules a little bit to get the language to be as powerful as you want it to be. And again, here's the class where Java would have it, where they would allow the multiple references, but as it says here, it would have to find out that this reference to J is to what they call an incomplete declaration. The type is known, but the initialization is not, and therefore would still have to disallow it. In our language and in Java, declarations occur only in one spot. But in other languages, C++, for example, has a kind of a nice feature that makes compiling a little nastier, but makes programming in some ways better. And that is you're allowed to chop a declaration into pieces. And particularly the main chop is between the header of a method and its body. One of the nasty things in Java is you get the whole beast in one place. And in some cases, people, for example, have automatic documentation that will skim a class, get the headers, but not get the body. Because users don't want the body, and it may be that you don't want the code to be available. As company policy, are people who buy the code to buy a product, do they actually get the source code, or do they just get the executable? So they actually get the source and can play with it. Oh, you must love that. If you know, some particular institution has a bright boy or girl who, you know, just goes ahead and says, I know better than those schmucks out at Epic. They, you know, they're doing something stupid, and I'll do it way better, and you have to clean up the mess. Well, in terms of incomplete declarations, it's a situation where sometimes you want to separate out the usage of a method, namely its header, from its implementation. One of the strong points about that is if a user does not know how something is implemented, he or she cannot rely upon that implementation legally, and that gives you the ability to change things. There must be cases where you decide this was poorly implemented, I could re-implement it better this way, but you certainly hope that current users aren't counting on the fact that you're doing one thing or another. So again, in coding in general, users are very bright people, and sometimes they figure out this is the way it's being done and count on that. And if you change something that used to work doesn't, and I'm telling you something you already know probably. So it's a situation here where languages try to support some of this, and what they do is say, here's a case where I can give you, from the user's point of view, the fact that there's going to be an integer function f of no arguments, but I'm not going to show you its body. There's another spot where its body will exist, and that'll be an implementation. And the notation they use is there'll be inside class C, so the C double colon, says this guy, even though it's physically outside, logically ought to be compiled and executed as if it were inside. So it says inside class C, there's an integer value f, and like C and C++, their type positioning is ugly. This int is part of f with the C double colon kind of shoved in the middle just to show you its location logically. So it says, okay, in this case, inside class C, here's the body of f, and you have to return i+1. The nasty thing about that is think about all the symbol table stuff I've just been talking about. So in this case, you run through class C and say, okay, I'm going to compile this guy. I've got the translation of class C. But of course, you don't because the method is incomplete. So I've got to say, okay, this guy's not complete. It's partial. Finish it off later. And it says, okay, here's a piece. And sometimes you're going to have different methods in different places completed, so you can have to spread around a bit, which is not all that great. But it says, when you're compiling this body, return i+1, you've got to recreate the symbol table and execute the compiler as if this were right following the integer f. So, for example, the guy talks about i+1. What i? Well, it's the I this guy would have seen if he had been compiled right here, and that means it's the field I in class C. So in this case, you open the class, close it, and then you got to reopen it and maybe several times and update the code. That's the nasty part of it. We don't have that. Java does not have it, but C++ does. And here's some explanation of why that's a useful thing to have. Pound sign includes and all that. So just I wanted to explain that to you. Something that's important. Classes, structs, and records. Almost all advanced programming languages have a way of gathering together a variety of data, giving them names, and putting them into a package. We have a class in Java and in CSX, and classes are generalizations of what in C were structs. What's the difference between a struct and a class? Any C or C++ experts here?
The struct is compared on the stack, right?
Yeah, that's the implementation. And part of it, structs normally just have data, and classes have methods, too. That was the big step forward, is that you can gather together methods to act on the data. And that's a big plus. These days, people love object-oriented programming. I don't see it as going away. So in that particular case, but in all these cases, what you can end up having is a structure that itself is really an indirect implementation of a symbol table. What classes, structs, and records go way back to earlier languages, have in common is that they're implemented as a symbol table. We already saw that. Remember we said at the very beginning of our class, what do? We open a symbol table, and it's going to have all the fields and all the methods declared in that class. If I had multiple classes, I'd have multiple symbol tables, and that means that when you have a class object and you say C.A, what that really means as far as the compiler is concerned is find the symbol table associated with C, look up A, but remember A itself might be another class, it might be another struct, it might be a record, so I can have cascaded references. And you can see those. I mean, for example, you used a little bit of that when you were doing the infamous production number 2 in getting together the AST. In the AST, you had to get to the root of the member decals, find its child fields, and go into it, and maybe go down one level deeper. So it was name of a class dot field name because the fields were references to other class objects. So that sort of thing exists. And the way this thing all works when you're actually implemented is you look up C, probably in the global symbol table. So you end up getting a symbol table for C. That has all the declarations for C, including the declaration of A. A, because it has some references to it, is probably the name of some kind of object. So say maybe A is of class K. So what happens is I look up class K. It's a symbol table. Inside class K, I said, you wanted B, so I look up B. B has some reference to its type, and this might be class L. So I end up looking up class L, and it's got an entry C, and that might be of type int. So the compiler goes through step by step by step, looking up things in the symbol table to finally figure out this big old monster is the name of a field that's of type int, and that's how you have access to it. So what we're doing at one level is really what languages do in many ways and in many levels. Packages, for example, in Java are simply symbol tables where the entries are a whole set of classes. So typically when you have a set of related classes, they go into some sort of library element. And I think I have an example of that. Yeah. So you do this all the time when you say system.out.println. Well, system is one of those classes that's accessible globally, and it's found in a standard package, java.lang. That means that you have access to that package without ever actually having to ask for it. There's a way of doing includes, I'll talk about that, that says, please give me access. But this one is automatic. So it says, okay, there's system there, and system has a static member, a field. So when I look up field, it says, hey, that exists, and that's of type printStream. PrintStream is a particular class that's presumably set for printing streams or streaming prints or something. And this has a method within it called printLine and another one called print and other things too that you can look up. So whenever you write system.out.println, you've actually exercising the symbol table to say first, find symbol. Well, that's in one of the default classes. That means if I don't have a local declaration for it, which I almost certainly don't, there are these classes that are universally available inside standard packages that will be looked up. And system is one of the main ones. System is just a plain old class, so it has members out, and out is a particular method, a particular field that has a method that called printline. And whenever you cascade dot this, dot this, dot that, that's exactly what's going on. You also have the interesting situation there that you have two levels of access in most programming languages. For our language, it won't be much of a problem. That is from inside and outside the class. I say it's not much of a problem because if you only have one class, where are you going to spend most of your time? Inside a class. But if you have multiple classes, access from the outside and inside, if it's permitted, is different. One of the things that's different is not everything's accessible from the outside. And in this particular case, we have class C, and it has a number of fields. Notice inside class C, I can access field I without using the dot notation. So inside of a class, I have normal lookup mechanisms. But if I'm talking about outside the class, I would have some object of class C. I would say that object name dot I to get at the field. So again, this is that symbol table business. When you're inside the class, you have the symbol table already there and open, ready for lookup. But once you leave the class by exiting the body of the class, the symbol table is closed, perhaps lost. But what happens is when I access a class, what did I say a class has as part of its declaration? Namely, the symbol table of all the fields and methods that that class provides, so that if somebody outside it says, say, give me that class.i, it looks it up and says, oh yeah, I exists. And in this case, it's a static integer and it's either public or private. We haven't gotten to that part yet. So again, you have these two levels. When you're inside the class, it's normal lookup a la compilers. Outside, it's this normal dot notation that says, look up the identifier. Identifiers of type class or struct or record have a symbol table as part of its information. And that allows you access to all the fields within it. And therefore, you use the qualified or dotted notation when you're outside the class. It's also the case that when you have these C++-like incomplete declarations, you again have to make sure it works the way I said a moment ago, namely that when you actually process the body of an incomplete declaration, it's placed in the correct context with the correct symbol tables open and available. I think I already talked about that. Public and private. It turns out that when you're declaring fields in languages like Java, things are public or private. We don't have that complication. Everything is public. But it's certainly the case that there are certain fields and certain data that you can understand why they were made private, so they cannot be accessed from outside the class. Information that manipulated only by methods, but not explicitly by the user. It turns out that's unfortunate, and there's a workaround in that we have public and private. But there's a sort of a mix between public and private that would be nice to have. And actually, there's a way to get that mix more or less in a lot of cases. And actually, we're doing that in our particular project. What's intermediate between public and private? Well, what's good and bad about them? Public says anybody can see and change everything. So when you're public, you have read access and write access. And that's all there is. So that's pretty powerful. Private says you don't have no reading and no writing. What some languages have played around with, and Java gives you a backdoor way of doing it, is something called read-only. And that name tells you everything. It's nice in many cases to say, yeah, you can look at the field, but you cannot change it. And there's all sorts of things, you know, ID numbers or something like that, or bank account balances. It's perfectly okay to know how much or how little you happen to have in your particular account. But thou shalt not change it in this situation. Everybody thinks, you know, that if you can find a way to game the software in a bank, you can actually keep the money. No, that's not true, of course. So read-only would say read yes. So read is okay, but no write. But it turns out that in a lot of the cases when I was building the AST and building a lot of the structure inside our AST, I came up with something that's pretty darn close to read only. And does anybody remember what I was doing in that case? Public final. So that doesn't work in all cases, and I think read only would be a nice thing to have, but public final. In many cases, obviously for bank account, it's not fine, because bank accounts change pretty rapidly. But in our AST, for example, it's saying, I don't care if you look at the AST fields, but I don't want you to mess with them, because I have this tree set up just right, and it's got everything just where it should be. So go ahead and look at it for debugging or testing or evaluation, but don't change it. And public final does that. So public final is a way of doing it. Having read-only as an alternative would be a way of doing that, Dan. There are languages that have all sorts of various ways of getting this. For example, in some cases, you're allowed to have access to a field, but only through methods that explicitly have a read method and a write method, and the programmer can control what a read method or a write method does. You think about it, that's pretty powerful. It says, I will allow you to read my data, but not all of it. And not, so mixtures. So that means, for example, you could look up my social security number, but it would be a sort of situation, it'd be 1XX3XXX, something like that, where you can see selected parts. And you see that all the time, where you say, this is information about the account that begins with or ends with blah, 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 but they don't give the whole number. It'd be pretty cool if you routinely could say, I'll give you access to my data to read it or to write it. It might be, for example, that you're allowed to write data if somehow we can figure out it's benign change. Most of you have some pretty simple names, but there are some people who have these humongous names that nobody ever spells right. And just think how cool it would be is if we could go in there and say, oh, okay, you screwed up my name yet again. It's not, you know, Medeshevitz. It's Mekashevitz in the situation. You got to go ahead and do it. And you could go ahead and change my name from this to that, where it's clearly a minuscule change. That's a spelling correction. But it's not the situation, you know, the situation where change my name from whatever it is to Obama's, you know, so I can go and fly in the helicopter to my next golf meeting or whatever it is situation. So just kind of saying I'm going to change my name, that'll make me equivalent, would not work. So having control at the level of not just read-only or write-only, but controlled reads and controlled writes are things that people have looked into. And I think has a lot of promise in future in controlled cases where control changes and control access is fine, but universal change or universal access is way too dangerous. And that thing's available. So think of public and private as just crude approximations to what people are developing. So how do you implement public or private? Well, normally all that works is, well, public is pretty easy. That's what most things are by default. The way you do private typically is you first look something up and see if it's accessible. But just as you check its type information and its kind information, you also can check access information. So you could say, for example, if I looked up C.I and it was outside and it was private, I could say, yes, C.I exists, but you're not allowed to access it because it's declared as private. And that would be a good way of separating the fact that it exists. You don't want to mislead somebody and say that field does not exist. Well, maybe you do, but let's say we want to be honest about it. Say this thing exists, but it's private and you may not have access to it. Or if you have gradations, all that. Does data here have levels of access, you know, eyes only or anybody or some of those things, you know, if you're in government or military, there's highly classified and not so highly classified and something that anybody who knows how to run a computer can figure out. And you can imagine having a sort of gradations like that to say, yeah, this data exists, but you have to have, you know, ultimate access to get to it. You have to be president of the company or governor or president or senator or something to get at it. They also have something protected. Has anybody ever used protected in Java? I keep teaching it. I never find anybody uses it. Yes, no? Protected is one of these intermediate things that's in subclasses. Subclasses can get at the data, but other people, it's kind of like private. Yeah, you've used it?
In C-sharp, there's a similar thing where anything in the same namespace can use it, and yeah.
Okay, good. So it's good to know that, that some of these ideas actually have a value. And Java also has this blank public access that I'm not going to talk too much about. Something that's important is the fact that oftentimes you have to get at external libraries. And there's a question of how you get at that. And there's various kinds of qualified access. So typically the way it's done in Java is there's various packages and they have various paths. So if, for example, there's a very useful package, or very useful class, I should say, in Java util that has vector. So I said, I want to use vectors, and I want to make them available as if they were pre-declared the way int and char and bool are. And what I can do is simply put in this particular reference and references directly, or I can import it and say, I'm going to make it accessible from now on in all uses. Or I can have an import on demand that says, out of this particular package, I'm going to need a lot of things from Java util. And what Star says is sort of an odd thing. It says, if you do an ordinary lookup using your usual symbol table rules and you don't find it, Don't make it an error immediately. Rather, go through all these imports, particularly the ones that are starred, and see if there's any possible definition in one of these. And I think there's a rule that you go through the imports in the order in which they're listed. So if they're in multiple packages, the first one references the first one found. So in that case, it says, yeah, I wanted a vector, and it doesn't look like it's declared locally. So go through these various classes or various packages containing classes and see if you can find it in some of the imports. And if you looked at the code very carefully, sometimes you have to go ahead and have these various imports available if you want to use some of the fancier classes. When I was doing the GUIs, for example, I had to find out exactly where they were sitting and do the right sort of imports, and you just copy that all over. It's just a detail, but it's really an important detail because it means there's a whole universe out there of useful classes if you give the right path and import them and say, yes, I want to use this or that. They could try to put everything in there, but then there would be a terrible clash of dozens of implementers trying to import things, and what if they clash? What if you and somebody else both use vector? How do I know which one to use? In this case, you pretty much say, I want this one. If you've got it, failing that, I'll try something else. Turns out that simple tables exist in places you never actually guessed that they might. If, for example, you use standard compilers, they oftentimes create something called an object file. Java creates something called a class file. And as you might imagine, these things have information about the code that's been generated and the data that's been allocated and declared. What people don't always appreciate is there actually are simple tables in these structures too. In a class file, for example, it mentions all the methods and all the public fields, not private, because privates are not accessible, but public fields that are accessible so that one class can actually say to a class object, please give me this method that I believe you have, and is actually looked up and accessed as the program is being linked together. Also, it turns out that for object files, has anybody ever gone through the great pleasure of doing the link edit step of a major program? Do your products need to be linked edited? In the old days, what happened is you'd have libraries and separate compilations, and they would all be brought together and link edited, which means all the external references that are symbolic have turned into actual numeric references, and you build the whole thing. And when the thing runs, it's beautiful, and when it doesn't run, it's disaster in a situation. But it turns out that translations of programs actually have symbol tables in them to allow the fact that it says, hey, I want to call printf, which is a very commonly used function in C. And it says, well, you've got to find an external definition of printf to satisfy reference. Or I'm implementing a sort of one sort or another, and here it is, and then anybody can have access to it. Okay, I think we're just like people when people get starting fidgety. Yeah. 17 seconds in counting. So let's take another break, and we'll talk a little bit about overloading and kind of finish up on the big over picture, and we'll actually start getting into some code structures. So we've got about 15 minutes, and we'll start again about 8 o'clock.